Case number 13-5069, Francis A. Girardi et al., appellants versus United States Department of Health and Human Services et al. Mr. Mannion for the appellants, Ms. Klein for the appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. I am Francis J. Mannion, representing the appellants in this case. The central question in this case should be whether the government has shown a compelling interest enforcing this particular family business to include contraception in its health plans against the family's religious beliefs. At the same time, the government has decided not to impose that same requirement on millions of other employers for both religious and non-religious reasons. Now, the district court never reached this question because, contrary to the Supreme Court's teaching in the Bilotti case, it asked the wrong question. It focused on the formal identity of the parties instead of on a law that we say, and that the government acknowledges, implicates religious liberty interests. The district court did answer these two questions. First, whether or not the Girardis as individuals are substantially burdened by the HHS mandate. The court incorrectly said no. And secondly, whether or not the Freshway companies are burdened by the mandate. Again, the court incorrectly said no. Had the court answered either of these questions correctly, in our view, it would have proceeded to the strict scrutiny test, which should have been easy, given the massive holes in the scope of the coverage written into this mandate and the ready availability of less restrictive means of achieving the government's goals. As we see this case, there are four paths or routes to get to strict scrutiny. The first one is to look at the Girardis as individuals and whether or not there's a burden on them. This is the order in which we've argued these things in our brief. The second is the Freshway companies as persons exercising religion under RFRA. The third is the what some courts have referred to as a pass-through standing, whereby a closely held family-type corporation such as this one can assert the free exercise rights of its owners. And fourth is a route that I think so far only Judge Walton in the district here used, which is the third-party standing doctrine. I'd like to begin by looking at the claims of the Girardis as individuals. Now, several things are undisputed. First, the Girardis are obviously persons under RFRA. Second, the Girardis own and control and make all the decisions for the Freshway companies, including what goes in and what's kept out of the company health plans. Third, the Girardis have a specific, well-documented religious objection to directing their companies to include coverage for contraception, sterilization, and things that, at least in their view, can cause early abortions in their health plans. Fourth, the HHS mandate that's being challenged here requires the companies to include those things in their plans or face significant fines. And five, those things can only be included in the plan if Francis and Philip Girardi direct them to be included. Given those undisputed facts, it's our view that the court should have applied the test of the Thomas case and asked whether the HHS mandate puts substantial pressure on the Girardis to violate or to modify their long-standing behavior and violate their religious beliefs. The common sense response is, of course it does. They either abandon their religious belief that they can't have their company pay for these things, or they go out of business. They lose their family's livelihoods. And while the compulsion may be indirect, as Thomas says, the infringement upon free exercise is nonetheless substantial.
Can I ask you just a question to begin? If we conclude that the Girardis can bring this suit as individuals, what is the limiting principle? Because they're a corporation and they're shareholders of this corporation. Does that mean that if you're a shareholder in GM, you could likewise assert free exercise right?
I think not, Your Honor. I think the limiting principle is ownership or at least control of the decisions that are made by the corporate entity.
So it's a CEO in a C corporation.
Not unless the CEO, which I wouldn't think would be the case, can make decisions for the corporation that are not ratified by the board of directors. In other words, the principle is ownership and control.
Suppose the board of directors unanimously are devout Catholics.
Mm-hmm. And the CEO speaks for the board of directors.
Yeah.
Yes, I would think so.
Same rule that you're advocating here?
Yes.
Same analysis?
Yes. I think there's discussion of that in the Austin case, the Supreme Court's Austin case, which was the case that Citizens United overruled. Justice Scalia goes into that whole principle of, and it's, of course, that's in the context of free speech, but essentially says it's not that difficult to determine who makes decisions ultimately for a corporation. And whatever that process is, board of directors or some other setup, that's what controls for purposes of speech.
In the cases in which certiorari petitions were filed in right. the Third Circuit and the Tenth, is there any issue in your case that is not contained within the questions presented in those cases?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
It's the complete overlap.
Yeah, taking the two cases together, there is. Probably in the Hobby Lobby case, they didn't reach the majority didn't reach the individual three judges. Yes, yes. That's simply about corporate free exercise. But in the Third Circuit case, both issues are discussed.
If we decide that the Gilardis could bring this suit as individuals, but we don't think the corporations have a free exercise right, what happens to the injunction? How does that work?
The injunction is currently in place.
Well, in other words, yeah. It went back and an injunction would be issued by the district court. How would that work?
It's an interesting question, Your Honor. You would have decided that the Gilardis can bring the case as individuals and presumably that the strict scrutiny, you would get to strict scrutiny and say the government has not carried its burden. The injunction would be against the government enforcing the mandate. I mean, it wouldn't make sense if it's not also applicable to the corporations, obviously.
There's a rule of civil procedure that covers that and talks about the injunctions being binding not only on the individual, in this case HHS, and in favor of, in this case, the Gilardis, but also entities and people that they're in concert with.
Acting in concert with, sure. That would probably be the principle there. So focusing again on the Gilardis as individuals, the government's response is that the Gilardis aren't forced to do anything, that because they've chosen to operate under the corporate form, there is no burden on them. But the corporate veil is not an iron curtain. There are exceptions, particularly in the area of First Amendment rights. The court in Citizens United specifically listed the kinds of special advantages that corporations enjoy, specifically limited liability. And the Supreme Court said there that the state cannot exact as the price of these corporate advantages the forfeiture of First Amendment rights.
Now, what is a substantial burden, assuming you're past standing?
The substantial burden is that the mandate requires my clients to do something that their religion tells them they cannot do.
Which, of course, we know is permissible in our constitutional scheme, and the cases are legion where that happens.
But we're talking about
merely saying it that way is not an answer to the question. There are lots of cases in which, and no one seems to attend to, and I've looked at it carefully, and I looked at all the other cases, mm-hmm. and those on your side of the issue skim past it. I don't know how you get past Lee, United States versus Lee. You cite it for a proposition that is uninteresting to me for the question that I would pose. The court was very clear there in saying every person cannot be shielded from all of the burdens incident to the exercise of every aspect of the right to practice religious beliefs. And on it goes. So
right.
A very strong statement.
Right.
There was no question that the court said there was absolutely a burden on religious free exercise, those who opposed the Social Security system. The court didn't doubt it for a minute, but they said we are a commercial operation and you're in play and you decide to come into the market. There are some things that you have to adhere to for the better good because there's a larger interest. And there are many cases like that, the Title VII, the handicap. There are many cases in the courts have routinely held that you can't prevail in those terms.
Well, Your Honor, the passage you're referring to in Lee is in the court's strict scrutiny analysis. We don't deny, we're not saying that there's an absolute right.
I'm just talking about this case. Take it all the way down the line. I don't know how you get past Lee. If you can get that far in the analysis, I don't see how the government doesn't prevail. I don't see what's different about this case in Lee. You have a national mandate. You have a requirement that lots of employers have to follow. Your employer is not obliged to do anything other than to contribute to the program. Your employer is not obliged to give contraceptives to anyone or to endorse abortion. In fact, quite the contrary. Your employer can pay what's required and then put up signs that say, I strongly oppose abortion, I strongly oppose contraceptives, whatever they want. And there are just so many cases like that. So there is a burden, but it is not one that we've acknowledged. And Lee has never been overturned.
We're quite comfortable that our case fits within Lee. Yeah. Because
I know you think you are, and I'm trying to figure out why.
Because the Lee court found that there was a burden on Mr. Lee's religious beliefs.
But there's a justified burden.
Right. And that's where strict scrutiny comes in. And if we get to strict scrutiny in this case, there is no way the government can justify this under strict scrutiny. Because when you talk about the national scheme in Lee, that's not what we have here. We have a Swiss cheese. According to some court's calculation, there are 191 exemptions from this mandate.
The heart of your argument is, I think what I'm hearing you say is, you can't prevail under Lee as is, but for your assertion that this is fundamentally a discriminatory system.
Yes, and I think that's the analysis that the Supreme Court teaches has to be followed in a RFRA case and the Ocentra case. What the Supreme Court says there is the government has to justify the application of its mandate or law to the particular claimant. And in Ocentro, the government had granted exemptions for something for hundreds of thousands of Native Americans using peyote, but was unwilling to grant an exemption for the 130 or so religious claimants in that case. Here, it's far worse than that. We have, in the Federal Register, 98 million. Some courts have calculated the number, 191 million exemptions on both religious and non-religious, for religious and non-religious reasons. There's no way that this is comparable to Lee.
But you certainly can't equate your corporation, a commercial operation that does not purport to be a religious operation, with those companies that are exempt on those terms.
Those are not the only companies that are exempt, Judge
Edwards. All right, they're small companies.
The grandfathered.
Okay. No, the grandfathering is limited.
The grandfathering is not limited according to the government. The government says it is a right, and it is you can maintain it indefinitely.
Well,
sure, as a practical matter.
All right, let's assume it's limited, as I read the statute. It's a limited. I don't see that of any moment. It's a limited. It's a pass-through period, and then at a certain period, it goes away. So, I don't know. Where is this vast sea of exemptions that are relevant?
Well,
you certainly can't equate yourself with religious corporations. This is not a religious corporation.
Right.
Okay, so they're out. In my view, just so you understand where I'm thinking, the grandfathering group is an insignificant group. And you can't equate yourself, frankly, with the nonprofits, can you? This is a commercial operation.
It's a commercial operation.
Okay, so we're not talking about a large group.
Well, Frank, candidly, I would disagree with Your Honor.
Okay,
it is a large group.
I'm trying to understand where you are because, I don't see how you get around Lee. And I understand what you're saying. You're saying there's a vast sea of exemptions. It's discriminatory. We should win. I don't see any vast sea of exemptions. I see some exemptions that are clearly explained in terms that we understand under the case law.
I would disagree with your assessment of the grandfathering exemptions.
Okay.
The regulation itself says it's a right and
so
it's indefinite.
Your case hinges on how we construe the grandfathering?
No, not necessarily, because the other exemptions have to be taken into account as well.
Yeah, well, I know. We've gone through them. Have I missed some?
No, but that's the point.
They're insignificant. The religious corporations... You can't argue that as a basis.
No, that's why we're here, because we don't qualify for any of the exemptions. We're saying that RFRA requires that we be given an exemption because of those other exemptions. We don't pretend that we're a religious corporation. What we do say, however, is that the exercise of religion is not necessarily limited to people in the quote-unquote religion business any more than in the Bilotti case. The Supreme Court rejected this approach, that freedom of speech for corporations is limited to corporations that are in the speech business. So I frankly disagree with Your Honor's assessment of the scope of the exemptions. They're massive. And
there's a case that you did. I don't believe you cited that supports the proposition that you're arguing in favor of, the Supreme Court case, the Greater New Orleans case.
Not familiar with it, Your Honor.
Greater New Orleans broad case, the First Amendment case, not religion,
right,
speech. And Justice Stevens, in the opinion, dealing with this sort of thing. It says there's the flaw in the government's case, and this is in the scrutiny, is that the operation of this statute is so attended, so pierced by exemptions and inconsistencies that the government cannot hope to exonerate it. And it was an advertising case, but the Supreme Court struck it down. It seems to me that that case supports your argument. But the district court never got that far.
That's correct.
Right. I mean, the threshold question here is identifying whose religious beliefs are being burdened.
Right.
And the next question is whether substantially. And I just want to ask you about that. I can't remember the procedural posture of this case. Did the government answer the complaint?
No, they did not.
So, as the case comes to us, we have allegations by your clients that running their company in the manner that the mandate requires violates their religious beliefs.
That's right.
And that's uncontested.
It's uncontested.
So the question then becomes, what is the relevance of the corporate structure? Unless there's another religious tenet that says if your company is a corporation, then you have absolutely no moral obligation to run it in a manner that is consistent with Catholic teaching. Mm-hmm. There is no such thing.
Our clients interpret their Catholic faith the opposite way, that they are required to run it in a manner consistent with their religious faith. And that's what they've done for as long as anybody can find records for.
Is there any significance to the fact that at least the penalty portion that they would be subject to is part of the Internal Revenue Code, and that under the Internal Revenue Code, at least for income tax purposes, the corporate form is disregarded because this is an S-corporation?
It may well be. The fact that it's an S-corporation means that even though there is this corporate form, the net result, income and loss, of the penalties here goes on Frank and Phil Gilardi's separate individual income tax returns, part of Schedule K.
It's a complete pass.
Exactly.
And that's true of what, limited liability?
I believe so.
As well
as I believe
other
so.
Associations.
I think that when we're dealing with a law that impinges upon fundamental First Amendment freedoms, the Supreme Court has taught we don't allow form to triumph over substance, and that's what we're arguing here.
No, I think what Lee says is if you're in the commercial market, you have to give up some for the greater good.
I agree, Judge. It does say that, but what we say is that's part of the strict scrutiny analysis.
And Congress had some exemptions as well.
Nothing like in the...
Well, that's your case. You're saying the exemptions here are so overwhelming, are so large in their number that you should win. Because you can't possibly get around Lee. Because Lee had exemptions, and the court gave it the back of the hand. They said, of course Congress can make those decisions. That's what we do. And you cannot come in, they said, and impose your religious values on society and deny to your employees, who are larger than you are, what Congress has decided is the better good that they should be entitled to if they choose to have it. That's the way Lee looks at it. That is, you can't bring your religious free exercise and overtake the larger good in society. We just don't allow it to happen.
Views on anybody?
No. The Gilardis are not imposing their religious views on anyone. Their employees are certainly free to buy and use contraceptives anytime they like.
And
the Gilardis are simply saying...
How is it different paying them wages?
That's the line they draw, which the Thomas case and others teach the court may not second guess. They draw that line. It has to do with principles of Catholic moral theology about formal and material cooperation with evil.
I don't get what the plaintiffs here are obliged to do other than to contribute to a national scheme. They are not in any way obliged to give up their beliefs.
They're not at all contributing to a national scheme. They have to literally check off and in the joint appendix, contraceptives, sterilization, abortion. It's not the same as contributing to a national scheme through Social Security taxes or income taxes. It's quite different, Your Honor.
Are any of the employees who work for these employers obliged to take the contraceptive benefits?
Under the HHS mandate, they will be.
They're obliged to?
Not to use them,
of course.
But they'll be part of the plan.
Of course not.
Right.
Okay.
I see that my time has expired, if the panel has no other questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Elisa Klein for the federal government. I will turn to strict scrutiny, but if I may begin with the threshold point that the Sixth Circuit recently made, which is that the claims there and here in all of these contraceptive coverage cases are asking the court to interpret RFRA in a way that would disregard the corporate form. And the Supreme Court in Cedric Kushner has made clear that even if you only have a single shareholder, the principle, the tenet that a shareholder is distinct from the corporation holds true, and it has interpreted the federal RICO statute in accordance with that background common law principle. There are other examples that we've cited in our cert petition. This is not a contested proposition. And so the question, we have here an issue only of statutory interpretation. What did RFRA do when Congress enacted it in 1993?
Well, the Dictionary Act defines persons as corporations.
Unless the context indicates otherwise, and the language of RFRA is persons' exercise of religion. So when you say the claim is by regulating the Freshway Foods Corporation, and that would be any form of regulation, that is tantamount to personally burdening, Frank and Philip Gilardi as individuals. And we are not aware of any support, the 200 years before RFRA was enacted.
Yeah, but that's a religious question.
No, Your Honor, this is a statutory question about
whether regulating freshways, as you say, burdens the Gilardi's exercise of religion depends on the tenets of the Catholic Church. It doesn't depend on a statutory interpretation, they say it burdens us, and that allegation is still outstanding. The government hasn't contested it. Will you contest that? Will you say the Catholic Church or the Catholic religion does not recognize the burden of on the Gilardis from running their company, their solely owned company, in that way?
I'm distinguishing between the sincerity of their claim and the legal question. We are not asking the court to interpret scripture.
You don't contest their basic argument that to run the company in the way that the government is requiring us to do through fines violates our religious beliefs. That's the heart of their position. Do you contest that or do you not?
We have not contested the sincerity of their claim.
Do you?
At this point, we have no reason to. It's at this stage. But as a matter of law, we are saying that that does not state a prima facie case under RFRA, that it would be wrong to interpret RFRA to allow, I'm not sure where the line is, but controlling shareholder, officer, whatever the claim is, to say that when you regulate a corporation, as the for-profit business, as the corporation, that you then reverse pierce the veil and say this is, for legal purposes, a substantial burden on the individual who owns the controlling stake, is the CEO.
So to follow up on that, then, if the Gilardis had established their business as a partnership, I assume you would then agree that they have standing?
Yes. All of our other arguments would be the same. We would not acknowledge that the particular burden of which they claim is substantial. We would argue that strict scrutiny is satisfied.
Even if they clearly had standing as individuals, your argument would be that the mandate does not impose a substantial burden on them.
That's correct. There are a number of independent arguments, but the threshold problem with the claims here and in Autocam and Conestoga Wood and Hobby Lobby, and most of these are S corporations, is the same point, which is that you do not interpret RFRA or other federal statutes in a way that disregards the background principle that the Supreme Court reiterated in Cedric Kushner, but it's been said many times. A corporation is distinct from its shareholder, CEO, president.
It's not a background principle of the Internal Revenue Code, though, is it?
There is a, as Your Honor referenced, a specific provision in the tax code that gives a tax benefit to certain types of corporations, S corporations, if they have fewer than 100 shareholders, and that avoids double taxation.
Under subchapter S, this Freshways only has one shareholder, right?
These corporations have the two.
No, they're treated as one under the unsubtitled.
Oh, yeah, oh, correct. I believe that's correct.
Because
yes.
they have a common ancestor.
Yes, and many of these pending cases, it's a sole shareholder. That Hobby Lobby and Conestoga and Autocam all have several, but there are lots of other cases that have a sole shareholder, and our argument is exactly the same.
So your view, then, that the corporate form itself has this effect, doesn't that mean, then, that the state, which allows them to incorporate, is actually imposing an unconstitutional condition? It's basically saying if you get these benefits, you have to give up certain constitutional rights to do it.
If I could unpack the answer. First, there is no constitutional claim before the court.
I understand.
And,
but
you know, we explained in district court why post-Smith there is no viable free exercise claim here. The only question before this court is the statutory one, and for 200 years, no corporation or sole shareholder has ever obtained an exemption from any form of regulation on the theory that's being urged here, which is that you pass through the corporation and treat corporate regulation as if it were regulation of the CEO or controlling shareholder. There is no support in any Supreme Court case. The plaintiffs here and elsewhere rely on a Ninth Circuit decision called Townley, in which the Ninth Circuit, it went on to reject the free exercise claims, but it said essentially there's no difference between a closely held corporation and its controlling shareholders, but it did not address any of the corporate law principles that are crucial here, and the Third Circuit and the Sixth Circuit explicitly rejected the Townley pass-through theory. And just, if I could make sure to address the strict scrutiny point.
Well, before you get to that, let's suppose that you had a religion, and one of the beliefs spelled out in the sacred text was that if you own and run a company, and your company, corporation, violates our moral principles, you are just as guilty of a sin as if you did it yourself. Suppose that's the religious principle. Would your argument still be that the corporate form trumps the religion, the religious precepts?
Yes, as a matter of law, under RFRA. We are taking as a given that your hypothetical is their belief, that they sincerely believe that the teachings of the Catholic Church prevent them from, I don't know, acting as officers of a corporation that complies with the federal law, and that compliance, we're not taking on the sincerity. We're saying as a matter of law that Congress, when it enacted RFRA, did not countenance that type of claim.
Did not intend that? Is that the idea?
Well, certainly there's...
How do you get to that proposition? I mean, it is a statutory interpretation, but... Just treat persons not as the corporation, but as the individual sole owners. How do you get to the proposition that Congress didn't intend to recognize the sort of idea, precept that I just gave you?
All right, well, a few different points. First, as the Sixth Circuit explained, we've got, and the dissent in Hobby Lobby, 200 years between the adoption of the First Amendment and the enactment of RFRA, which is meant to restore the Supreme Court's pre-RFRA jurisprudence. There's never been a claim like that. Second, the corporate
so
form...
So it's an open question. If you were asking
what was Congress doing when it enacted RFRA, and you have to say it is restoring something, you would not conclude that for the first time it is authorizing courts to disregard the corporate form, look past the regulation of a general business corporation, and treat it as if this were a burden on the individuals who are officers of the company.
Well, I think the courts have recognized that RFRA goes beyond simply overruling Smith.
I'm not aware of this. I know there are courts that have said RFRA restores the pre-Smith jurisprudence.
Because of any exercise, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I mean, I think the court has been fairly clear that, no, this is, if you're looking to the body of precedent, you look to the Supreme Court's pre-Smith jurisprudence. And quite conspicuously, what you have are claims by natural persons, like Sherbert and Yoder, which are the two cases cited in RFRA, and some claims by churches, which is unsurprising. These are organizations formed in order to exercise religion. So no example in all of RFRA's, you know, the Supreme Court precedent history, nothing in the debates, nothing in the legislative history, if the court is inclined to look there. A lot of background federal employment law, federal employment statutes, in which there are specific exemptions for certain types of employers, but those have been confined to essentially churches with a small c, religious institutions. And
let me ask you in that regard, is your argument limited to nonprofit corporations?
Our argument, if I understand the question, is that a for-profit corporation is...
I meant that. That's
okay, if that's, yes, if that's the question, our argument here, you know, we may have different arguments, and there are pending cases in district court that are brought by nonprofit religious institutions that are challenging the new rules that were just issued in July, so I'm just flagging those. But for the purpose of all the cases that are now in the courts of appeals and our cert petitions, it is sufficient that we are talking about for-profit corporations.
And that's your way of distinguishing churches that incorporate?
Yes. Yes. You know, the Supreme Court has said that Congress could, in Title VII, exempt not just the church's religious activities, but it could go all the way to the church's nonprofit activities. There, in Amos, it was the Mormon church that ran a nonprofit gymnasium. And the reasoning was it was to avoid entanglement concerns, that for a church to have to predict in advance whether a court would regard its, you know, soup kitchen or other activities as religious or secular is itself problematic. And so that Congress could go beyond the core exemption for a church's religious activities and get to the Mormon church running a nonprofit gymnasium. But there is nothing that would take the step to for-profit business merely because it has directors, officers, controlling shareholders who have religious
beliefs. So it has to be a 501c corporation, is that the idea?
I just want to be careful not to step into issues that may still be the subject of litigation in the district court, but nonprofit religious institutions.
Recognized by the Internal Revenue Service?
I don't believe that that is part of the definition, but there are piggybacks off of other established exemptions in federal law.
I thought you were relying at least on some of these. I can't get it out of the district court's opinions, but it, dealing with 501c status, which raises a question in my mind. If your distinction, now you may deny this, but if your distinction rests on the treatment of a particular corporation under the Internal Revenue Code, under Section 501, then why isn't an S corporation exempt? Not exempt, but why isn't it that the shareholders of the S corporation are the focus rather than the corporation itself?
Well, again, this is what we're not actually. I mean, this court's precedent interpreting the Title VII exemption. So actually, it's the University of Great Falls case is interpreting the NLRA exemption, but relying on Title VII principles. Talks about nonprofit. But I don't understand this court to be saying that's tantamount to 501c3. So essentially, if you look at the employment law statutes against which Congress enacted RFRA, there is precedent to exempt not just the church, but the church's nonprofit activities, whether or not a court might regard those activities as religious or secular. As this court explained in the Great Falls case, it's hard to decide whether a church's activities are religious or secular, but there's a bright line, easy way to distinguish between nonprofit activities and for-profit activities.
I just want to make sure that I understand the government's argument here. Are you saying that the government takes the position that for religiously observant owners of corporations, there is no free exercise right? Or are you saying, in fact, that if it's a neutral and generally applicable law, no one has a free exercise right?
We are saying that as a matter of interpretation of RFRA, there is no substantial burden on the controlling shareholder or officer based on the generally applicable regulation of the corporation.
And the reason there's no substantial burden, in your view, is because it's the corporation that has to implement the mandate?
It's the corporation that has all of the obligations. It is not the personal responsibility of, you know, Mr. Gilardi or the Greens or the Hans.
And that's regardless of what the religious tenets said.
Yes, so if you had...
It doesn't matter that the religion says that you can't excuse yourself from a violation of the moral code by claiming that it was the corporation that did it, not you. But that doesn't matter to the government.
Exactly. We are not asking the court to question that. And just I want to make sure I touch on strict scrutiny.
That even if they brought this suit as individuals, there still would not be substantial burden.
They are plaintiffs in this case, and we think the Sixth Circuit had the analogous thing. Correct. There's neither standing, but also it's a substantive legal principle that informs.
I'm just trying to understand. Yes. You said it just a moment ago that because it is the corporation who has all the burden of implementation, there's no substantial burden on the Gilardis. But you also said even if they brought it as individuals, you would argue. You would make all the same arguments. In other words, that there is no substantial burden. I just want to make sure.
That's exactly right. And I understand they have brought the claim as individuals.
On the one hand, it's because the corporation is doing all the implementation. But your argument that even if they brought it as individuals, there would be no burden. That's what I'm trying to understand.
If the question is forget about the corporation and this were just a sole proprietor, the argument would still be that there's no violation, but the reasons would be different. You would then be dropping down to our other arguments that this particular burden is too attenuated and strict scrutiny is satisfied even if you were to get to strict scrutiny. And just make sure I respond to the grandfathering argument. I mean, from my recollection of the survey of the 30-plus cases, to the extent district courts or the Tenth Circuit have ruled against us, it's been on the basis really of the grandfathering provision, and we just think that's a fundamental misunderstanding of the grandfathering provision.
I don't read your regs the way the plaintiffs argued that. They claim that your regulations say they go on indefinitely. That's not my understanding.
Well, it may be that we're saying the same thing in different ways. If you raise co-payments, raise deductibles, decrease employer contributions, materially reduce benefits, all the things that plans do all the time, you lose grandfathering status. So it's not, sometimes the term grandfathering means you're forever protected. This is not the sense in which the Act, the Affordable Care Act, is using grandfathering. Okay. There are no further questions. Thank you.
Briefly, Your Honors, what the government's argument in these cases comes down to is heads the government wins, tails the religious claimant always loses. This presents a situation that the Supreme Court precedent that's the real background of RFRA could not possibly countenance. So if you have a kosher deli owner who goes into business and decides, I'm going to incorporate, and a law is passed requiring all food establishments to sell pork or some other violation of kosher regulations, no one could bring a RFRA claim, according to the government. If you have a Sabbath observer who, for sound business reasons, decides to incorporate, and the government, to encourage economic growth, requires all businesses having more than, say, 2 employees to be open 7 days a week, no one could bring a RFRA challenge there.
I think you're really overstating it. And again, you ignore Lee. The Supreme Court has addressed this. To maintain an organized society that guarantees religious freedom to a great variety of faiths requires that some religious practices yield to the common good.
I agree.
The cases go on and on and on. And it's just not a surprising notion. We can't have people just announce, wait, I firmly and absolutely believe in X. And X happens to be inconsistent with the statute you just passed, and I really believe it strongly, and it comes from wherever the great leader is in this particular religious group, and no one doubts that they're sincere. That notion is not a viable notion. That's not the way we run it.
Judge, that's the holding of Employment Division v. Smith, which RFRA was enacted to overturn.
RCRA did not overturn Lee. The principles in Lee have been recited by the Supreme Court over and over again. They are viable principles, and sometimes free exercise has to give way to the common good, depending
right.
upon whether the government has shown that there is a good
when
interest.
There's a compelling interest
right.
being pursued by the least restrictive means, which there certainly is not in this case. I see that my time has expired.
Okay.
I'd like to thank the panel.